I am Anthony Fowler.
I'm Will Howell.
And I'm Viola Giuda, and this is Not Another Politics Podcast. We have fall outside. It's getting cold. And one thing that's coming with that is the elections, the midterm elections. One interesting thing that I've observed recently in the media is that there are those Republican candidates that when running in Republican primaries, they were really adamant supporters of Trump.
Last big night of primaries before the midterms, and the results bring new clues about Donald Trump's power in the Republican Party.
So, for example, Donald Bolduc, who is running for senator from New Hampshire, he really ran on this idea that there was electoral fraud during the 2020 election.
I signed a letter with 120 other generals and admirals saying that Trump won the election, and damn it, I stand by my election.
And now, once he secured his position in the race, he's actually sort of backtracking from that. He acknowledged that the election was fair and square.
You know, live and learn, right? And I've done a lot of research on this, and I have come to the conclusion, and I want to be definitive on this. The election was not stolen.
So that makes me think, what's going to prevail? How is he going to behave once he's in Congress? Is he going to be an extremist because he had to win the primaries, or is he going to be a moderate? Because looking forward, he's going to think about the general election. What do you think, Will?
Yeah, I think this is a common story that we hear. One, that there's this shift from primaries to general elections, and people who behave in the context of primaries more ideologically extreme moderate their positions in the general. But also that when in office, there are a whole lot of members of Congress who are running scared, not with an eye towards the general electorate, but with the possibility that they're going to get primaried. And that the way that they ostensibly are meant to avoid being primaried, that particular threat, is to shore up their credentials as good liberals or good conservatives. And so that their voting record then should hew to the extremes of the spectrum rather than to moderate in order to forestall a challenge in the primary. This is a view of our politics. It's not always informed by a lot of careful research that actually looks at the extent to which this is generally true. It's sort of told anecdotally. But Anthony, you talked to somebody who has written a paper that investigates this issue with a good deal of care.
I did. I spoke with Jim Snyder from Harvard, and he has written a great paper that we talked about, and he's written a lot of other papers about primary elections and actually has a book with Shigeo Hirano on primary elections. And we talked about exactly this question. Should we worry that the reason there's so much polarization in Congress is because the members of Congress are worried about their primary elections? So, you know, a lot of people make this just kind of claim without thinking very carefully about what they're even saying. But if you think about it for a second, you have to have some counterfactual, some alternative, right? So if you think primaries are causing polarization, then what's the alternative? And historically, the alternative to primaries has been something like a party convention, something like the party leaders get together in a room and they decide who the nominees are going to be, as opposed to some big open election where the general public can vote on it. And so, you know, most states in the U.S. switch from something like a convention to a primary over 100 years ago. But there's a handful of states that did so more recently. So they look at Connecticut, Delaware, Indiana, New Mexico, New York, Rhode Island, and Utah. And all of those states, sometime between 1938 and 1976, they switched from something like a convention to what we think of as now a modern primary for choosing their members of Congress, for choosing candidates for Congress. And so in this paper, Jim and his co-authors are looking at those switches. They're asking, when a state switches from a convention to a primary, how do we see a corresponding change in how members of Congress from those states are actually voting in Congress? And of course, we can compare the changes in those states to the changes in other states that didn't make any change to their electoral system to try to estimate what the effect of that is. So it's one of these difference in differences setups that we've talked about before on the show. That's the basic idea. And so they're trying to estimate in this kind of modern era, post-New Deal, what's the effect of switching from a convention to a primary.
On voting behavior, what particular about their voting behavior are they looking at?
They're looking at the ideological extremism. So they're looking at some summary measure of all the roll call votes that's taken. They're using the classic DW nominate that lots of political scientists look at. And they're trying to measure, does this person seem to be voting in a relatively extreme way or a relatively moderate way? And they're trying to ask, do primaries seem to increase extremism as measured by roll call votes, or do they decrease it? I I want to talk to you today about a paper that you wrote, you published in 2010, so it's a bit of a classic now, called Primary Elections and Partisan Polarization in the U.S. Congress. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how you got started on this project and what made you interested in this question to begin with?
One thing that I want to raise right away, which doesn't seem to be always part of every discussion, is that we have to nominate candidates somehow. So when people beat up on primaries, that's fine, but you have to ask the question, well, if you don't use primaries, what are you going to do instead? The little bit of evidence that we have out there suggests that if we hand things over entirely to party elites and activists and, for example, convention delegates, then it's not at all obvious that that's going to produce moderate candidates. In fact, activists are even more extreme than primary voters and so on and so forth. So I think that's something we have to think about when if we're going to try and use an electoral reform to fix this problem. It's very unlikely that it's going to involve taking the nominations out of the hands of voters and putting it in the hands of an even smaller group. If anything, what we probably really need to do is get more voters participating in primaries or something like that, which may be the top two or, I don't know, ranked choice voting in Alaska or some completely different system. But that's not even just really a primary reform. It's like a reform of the whole electoral system.
So what's the first analysis in this paper? You essentially estimate what's the effect of implementing primaries, you know, across a bunch of states when the alternative was a bunch of, you know, party insiders sitting in smoke-filled rooms and deciding who the nominees were going to be. Tell us a little about that analysis.
So let's compare within a state what happened under conventions, what kind of candidates were coming out under conventions, and then later what kind of candidates were coming out of primaries. And the one thing we do in the book that's additional to the paper, I mean, I don't want to keep bringing up the book because it's about the paper, but in any case, is try to do the handful, and again, even smaller number of comparisons of alternative ways that candidates get nominated today. So there are a few cases where candidates are not nominated by primaries. One case was Utah, which used conventions, pre-primary conventions, and if a candidate got 60% of the votes up until, I think, 2014, they won, and there was no primary. Connecticut also had a system of challenge primaries, and then Virginia has optional primaries still. And you could, again, compare what's going on when the primary is being used in those states with what's going on when the primary is not being used. And we didn't find really hardly any differences, essentially. And slight bits of evidence that people were even slightly maybe more extreme when in the direction of polarization when being nominated not under primaries.
You also look at voter turnout in primaries. Why is that interesting? And how do you study the effect of high and low participation in primaries?
Well, I think there the argument is that the smaller the electorate, the more likely it is dominated by extremists. So in a very low turnout situation, it's going to be hardcore activists and the most ideologically extreme voters maybe showing up. And then, of course, who do they prefer? An ideologically extreme candidate like them. And as more and more and more voters end up participating, the claim is that they're going to be more and more and more moderate. And there is some evidence for that. Like, it's not overwhelmingly huge differences in a high and a low turnout primary. And those actually can often be pretty different in terms of the levels of turnout. Because in a president, if you happen to have a primary for your, say, Senate candidate held at the same time as the presidential primary, and there's a hot presidential primary happen, then your turnout's going to be way higher. So there's the differences in the electorate can be very large. Despite those large differences in the electorate, we find, although statistically significant, not massive differences in how ideologically extreme the electorates are at those two different, comparing those two different kinds of times. But there are differences are there, and there are definitely a little bit more extreme voters showing up when in the cases where the turnout was low. And in principle, then they maybe nominate more extreme candidates given a choice. Now, of course, maybe the choices don't vary much, you know, mostly. And then also, it's not 100% clear that those voters aren't going to be, the more extreme voters, who could be like the more sophisticated voters as well, could also therefore be more strategic. We didn't do this in the paper really much, But looking at the House, you have a ton more elections to look at rather than the Senate. And then you have a lot more safe districts and competitive districts. And it appears that when there's a choice between an extreme and a moderate candidate and the district is safe for the party, then there is some evidence that they're more likely to pick the extreme candidate by a little bit. But when it's a competitive district, the moderate is just as likely to win as the extremist, the relatively extreme candidate, as best you can measure those things, and suggesting some kind of strategic action, at least, you know, looking at, as if either voters are strategic or the elites are giving them cues that are making them look strategic and so on and so forth. But the moderate's more likely to win in the competitive case than in the safe district for the party.
And you also look directly at the ideological makeup of the people who vote in primaries and generals. How do we measure that, and how do we see how much that matters?
Yeah, so that's, you know, surveys and exit polls and stuff like that. The usual ideological self-placement, which has a problem that, you know, most people put themselves as moderate, and then when you ask them a large battery of questions, they often don't look so moderate. Relying on the self-declared ideology, you don't see massive difference between those who vote in the primaries and the rank and file who show up in the general election from the party. So although when the electorate is small, there's a bit of a difference. On average, the difference is not very large at all.
Yeah, you find there, I mean, very strong correlations for the ideology of the general electorate, which makes sense. I mean, that's correlated with whether you get a Democrat or Republican, and there's big differences between Democrats and Republicans. For the primaries, the results are a lot weaker, and at least in some cases, the sign's even kind of opposite what you would expect. Is part of the story here that maybe these extreme voters aren't so strategic, that when you get a more extreme primary electorate, they're more likely to nominate someone who's less likely to win the general, and so there's kind of competing effects here?
So I guess when I think about it is, when you would divide the world into like competitive areas, safe areas from either party, the big puzzle is in the competitive areas, why aren't either voters or candidates or even donors and other elites, why aren't they focusing tons more effort on getting the more moderate candidates to run in the first place, which they don't really appear to, and then win from both parties? And so that's the big puzzle out there. And I think that the primary electorates are like, you know, they get to the last move after all these other moves are made. And very often the choice they face is not that exciting. Extremist one versus extremist two is a very common outcome. And so there they go. They flip a coin.
Let's talk about the election results for a second, because I think that is interesting. We've had Andy Hall on our show, and we've had Brandis Gaines-Roan on our show, and they've talked about empirical evidence showing that indeed relatively extreme candidates perform worse in general elections, and you've done a lot of work on that as well, and you essentially confirm that here. But kind of an open question for a lot of people is, okay, but what about the primaries? Maybe it kind of goes the other way in the primaries, and then it's not so clear anymore whether extremists are, you know, worse off than moderates are. But you look at that question. What do you find there?
So one thing is for primaries, which you have to start with, is whether or not there's even a contest to begin with. Because even for U.S. Senate primaries, and even more for any other office, basically, except for like governor, there's a ton of races that are uncontested. So I think all results then have to be caveated with that. So if you see an incumbent challenged in the first place in the primary, that's like almost a red flag that something's wrong. Like maybe the person's ideologically too moderate, or ideologically, or, you know, there's been drift, you know, and think about, say, AOC beating Crowley. I think it was Crowley, right? He was there, he was an old timer, probably pretty moderate. And what happened was the district had gotten moved away from him in a large way.
And you would also expect that probably they could be lower valence, right? You're more likely to get a primary challenger when you've got a scandal or you're doing a bad job. And so there's that bias built in.
Exactly. So in any case, so what you find is that for sure it's the case that an incumbent is more likely to be challenged in a primary when they're in a safe district for their party. We look at another variable to account for: how often do primaries occur in this state anyway, for various reasons, like, well, it's really easy to get on the ballot. There appear to be lots and lots of different interest groups all around to maybe endorse you. There's not like a rigid party machine that picks one candidate and throws all their support behind that candidate, and so nobody else bothers to run. So I'm thinking, for example, in Massachusetts, if there's an open seat, tons of people show up, throw their hat in the ring just routinely for any old office in the Democratic primary. And there is no organization, and there's tons of different ways to maybe win. And so your typical race will have four or five or at least three, you know, pretty solid candidates running. So some states are like that. In other states, it seems much more managed or something, and fewer people run, and incumbents are very rarely challenged, and so on and so forth. And so we try and proxy for that by what happens not for the U.S. Senate races, but in all the other seats, all the other elections that happen in that state, statewide races at least. You know, how often are people challenged there in primaries? How often is there a primary contest? How often is it really contested in a serious way, and so on and so forth? And we use that to kind of like serve as a variable to try and measure how worried should a given senator be that they might get challenged in their state primary, you know, when they're doing the regular old things, to try to see whether or not, after controlling for that factor, as a function of how ideologically extreme or moderate or whatever, how often are you even challenged in the first place, and then how many votes do you get? So we use that, and we find, for sure enough, that what's going on with these other offices matters a lot. And then in terms of the ideology, you know, itself of the senators, well, it looks a little bit like yes, it depends on exactly how you do it, but there's some evidence that you're a little bit more likely to be challenged in the primary if you're ideologically moderate, but the severity of the challenge doesn't seem to really matter. The odds of having a really a primary that you might have a good chance of losing, that doesn't seem to vary much depending on your ideology.
Do you think there have been any important changes since a lot of this research was conducted? We have had the Trumpist candidates. There's not a lot of them, but there's some of them. We've seen the rise of the Squad in 2018 and so on. If you updated some of these analyses, would you expect anything to change? Or?
There's one thing that definitely has changed noticeably in the data, which is simply the probability that an incumbent is even challenged at all in the primaries has way higher now, just really remarkably higher than they were 10 years ago. So that has definitely changed, and it started to ramp up. 2010 was already a bit of there was a little bit of a change with kind of Tea Party stuff happening. And it's much more pronounced in the Republican primary party now than in the Democratic primary, the probability that an incumbent is even challenged at all. The probability they lose has hardly moved. It's a little higher, I think, this last time. I have to check. I'm not quite sure about 2022, but up through 2018, and I think even 2020, the probability that an incumbent loses is still close to zero.
So you and Shigeo together have done more research on this topic than anyone else between all the papers and the books, and we've covered a lot. Are there any other interesting findings that are in the book that we didn't talk about today that you'd like to mention?
There's one other thing I think that we should keep in mind, which we don't talk about either in the book or in the paper or at all, but it's that when we read the newspapers, we see the sensational stories. And so I think we have the wrong view of what the situation is, right? There's a New Hampshire primaries, a Trumpist candidate wins the nomination, and that's the headline, and so on and so forth. And so we think, oh my gosh, you know, every primary is probably producing another Trumpist candidate. And we didn't see that same day in Rhode Island, you know, it was like, well, we had a sort of standard old case. There was like an open seat. Democrats are likely to win it, although they're not certain. Republicans have one person running in that primary. That person wins, of course. Democrats have like six candidates running in their primary. A couple of them are clearly quite good. The person who wins is like this, you know, is Seth Magaziner. And he wins because he's like state treasurer, former state treasurer, big name recognition, did a fine job as state treasurer, gets the endorsements of the former incumbent senator who's retired, or a House member who's retired, the state party organization, all the labor unions, and so on and so forth, and then slaughters the other candidates, or, you know, wins pretty handily. And so he's like not an extremist, weird, you know, he's like just Joe politician type, solid with a record and so on and so forth. And we have, you know, there's 100 of those cases, and they never make the headlines much because they're kind of boring to talk about. So I think where the media attention focused on a handful of high profile races where Trumpist candidates these days are winning has skewed a bit what we think.
we've done a show on how drifting to the extremes comes at a cost when candidates turn to the general election. We've got good evidence on that score. But what's being suggested here is there's not even a benefit from doing that within the context of the primary. We don't observe at least any correlational evidence that suggests that becoming more extreme shores up your electoral prospects during the primary season.
Yeah, that's right. And in some ways, I mean, that actually makes some sense to me, given the other evidence that we have, that most voters are relatively moderate, at least relative to their elected officials. So even among the people voting in the primary, I mean, I highly doubt that for your typical Democrat or Republican in Congress, there are a lot of primary voters who are more extreme than they are, who are saying, man, I wish they were even more extreme. There just aren't that many of those people around in the general public. And so it kind of makes sense that there isn't that strong force in primaries.
And yet the dominant story that we hear about primaries is that they're driven by high attention, highly engaged members of both parties who are more extreme relative to the general population. And I think you have to have this add-on point, which is that the way you satisfy them is you vote in ways that are consistent with their sincere policy preferences, and that they aren't forward-looking and thinking about a general election that suggests that, look, I could get somebody like me onto the ballot, but boy, if I do, I'm more likely to lose to the opposition. I mean, we need all that in play in order to make sense to suggest that there would be a reward for voting in ways that are more extreme. But the evidence on here suggests that there's just no rewards to be had.
So basically, we have two guesses for why this might be the case. Let me just try to make sure that I understand. So one guess is voters are forward-looking. So they say, well, I would like this very extreme senator who has voted very extremely in the past, but I know that if I select her during the primaries, she has no chance to win in the general election, and then I'm going to end up with a senator from the opposite party. So that would be one sort of story. And another story, which has nothing to do with being forward-looking, but it has something to do with sincere voting and preferences, is Anthony's story that, yes, when we go to the Republican primary, we have Republicans voting in this primary. So a median Republican is more right-wing than a median voter in the United States. But nevertheless, they are still not as conservative, not as right-wing as the current representatives that they have, for various reasons that are completely orthogonal to what's discussed in this paper. And in that case, seeing that they go even more to the extremes is really not going to help them, even in the primary elections, even if voters are not forward-looking.
How far do we want to push on this? I mean, both those stories are possibilities. This paper doesn't distinguish between them. To what extent is this an explanation, though, for the core story that's being told in this paper, which is that we don't see changes in voting behavior correlate with the incidence of primaries? That is, we don't systematically see legislators saying, oh, wait, there's a primary coming up. I better start voting off to the liberal side if I'm a Democratic, or off to the conservative side if I'm Republican. Like, why don't we observe that relationship? And one answer is that, well, there are no electoral rewards to be had by doing that.
It is useful to remember, again, we have to compare primaries to something. So if we're comparing primaries to, say, conventions of party leaders, I think one of our explanations is more compelling than the other one. So tell me if you agree with this or not. So the one story is strategic, forward-looking voters in primaries. I'm sure some of that is going on. I'm sure there are lots of voters who are thinking, well, I want the most electable candidate. But if I had to guess, wouldn't you guess that maybe the party leaders should have even more of an incentive to be strategic and forward-looking? They should be sitting around to themselves and saying, like, oh, you know, we really want to make sure we win this seat and so forth. At least in principle, you might think that party leaders are better positioned and better informed and better able to make those projections and think about that kind of thing. I could be wrong about that, but that seems possible. On the other hand, the other story was just about just the even if everyone votes sincerely, what are the ideological positions of people? There, it seems very clear to me that if I had to guess, the primary voters are probably more moderate than the party leaders. The people at the conventions, you're selecting for the most active people. You're selecting for the people who go to all the meetings, who feel really passionately, who are the most loyal partisans, who want to be there at the convention and have been selected to be there at the convention. Those people are crazy. Like, those people have the most extreme views in all of society. So it's not at all surprising to me that those crazy people, albeit they have strong incentives and they really want to win and they should be forward looking, but they also feel really strongly themselves that like that any deviation from party orthodoxy on policy would be terrible. And so it's not at all surprising that the conventions end up picking people that are perhaps even more extreme than the primaries would.
I think you're raising a very interesting point, but I think it might play out differently depending on when you are thinking about testing it. So I think nowadays, if you suddenly abandon the primaries and introduce this party nomination again, maybe your effect would occur and we would have even more extreme nominees. But, you know, when we are thinking about, I don't know so much what was happening at that time, but when we are thinking what was happening, you know, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, my understanding is the parties were a little bit stronger. They were less captured by the activists and so on. So it's possible that that's why they didn't see much of an effect at that time. But I want to go back to one thing that you said.
I think the activists are the party, though. Like, I don't know who the party is if not the activists. It's the party is the people who are willing to go to a million meetings and care really, really passionately about things. And so I'm not sure if that's an important distinction.
Yeah, but I think, you know, in the past, and again, I might be completely wrong, but I would think in the past, parties were more representing elites. So it wasn't only about the passion, it was also about the power that you had. And with power comes more forward-lookingness because you really want to defend your interests. So you know, what I'm just saying is that I think your story is interesting and it might manifest itself very differently at different points in time, depending on who is actually playing this role of the party. But I want to go back to you sort of favoring this explanation for the null results over the other one, because, you know, if voters really are more moderate than their candidates, then you should see a correlation between voting while in Congress and your subsequent success even in the primaries, because but the opposite than what they were searching for, that you should see that the more moderate I am, the more likely I am also to win the primaries. And we don't seem to see that. So I want to how you were thinking about this.
It is curious that, right, it's not that the sign switches. It's that there's a null effect on voting behavior, somebody's established record, and their probability of being challenged in a primary and their ultimate vote share, particularly when we're talking about, as you said, Anthony, the subset of people who are paying the most attention to politics and therefore should be most likely to know about a legislator's behavior in Congress.
So there's two possible explanations for that. One obvious one seems to be that, yes, I mean, maybe the primary electorate really is more extreme than the general electorate. It probably is. I'm sure it is. It definitely is. And so maybe the primary electorate is kind of, you know, half more extreme and half more moderate than these extreme elected officials, whereas the general electorate is clearly on the moderate side. The other possibility, I think, that I'm going to lean on is you could have a primary challenger that's more extreme than you. You could have a primary challenger that's more moderate than you. And so it could kind of in principle go either way. Suppose it were the case that most of the primary voters are more moderate than you are. If your challenger is more extreme than you are, then that's going to be good for you. And if your challenger is more, you know, and so.
But if you're more moderate, there's less room for an even more moderate to step in.
That's right. So under that story, there still should be some correlation there, but it's going to be harder. It's going to be harder to see it, especially when we don't have this data on where the challengers are and so forth. Whereas for the general, it's sort of always the case that your opponent's on the other side and more moderation is always good for you. It's a little bit murkier in the primary case. And of course, a lot of the primary opponents might be right around where you are, and there's not actually a big distinction ideologically. And so maybe that, you know, the primary competition could be largely about competence or effort or other things like that rather than just ideology. So certainly it makes sense that there's a kind of mitigated effect in the primaries, that there's less of a correlation. There's no obvious story as to why it's exactly zero. It doesn't have to be exactly zero, but it makes sense that it's certainly weaker in the primary than in the general.
I mean, in general, I think it's actually hard to guess what the correlation we should expect theoretically, because what we are, I think one thing worth emphasizing is that what we are seeing is equilibrium outcome. The voting behavior in Congress is in response to some prediction of how I'm going to be rewarded during the primaries and during the general election. Theoretically, I don't know what relationship I would expect to see, and it might be that actually the relationship that we should see is another relationship.
It could be. Yeah, it could be. And theoretically, it could be that like the high quality, high competent, that they're freed up to just be as extreme as they want to be, and they know they're going to get reelected anyway. And so there's kind of a bias there where it's going to look like extremism is good, but really it's extremism is kind of something you're consuming, you know. It could go the other way too. You could tell different stories. I mean, it's unlikely that the actual effect is zero. Like, there probably is some non-zero effect. And if I had to guess, it probably goes in the direction of being, but I don't know. I mean, but either way, I mean, the primary effect is clearly weaker than the general effect. So if you wanted to say, hey, why aren't these elected officials moderating more? They would clearly do better. It's not a good response to say, oh yeah, they have to worry about the primary, because there's no clear evidence that they would do better in the primary if they were more extreme.
And yet that's what we hear again and again. And we hear that, I mean, that testimony offered not just by political generalists and observers, but by candidates themselves who justify, right, the positions that they're taking out of concern about the possibility that they're going to get primaried.
Have you ever wondered what goes on inside a black hole? Or why time only moves in one direction? Or what is really so weird about quantum mechanics? Then you should listen to Why This Universe. On this podcast, you'll hear about the strangest and most interesting ideas in physics, broken down by physicists Dan Hooper and Shalma Wegsman. If you want to learn about our universe from the quantum to the cosmic, you won't want to miss Why This Universe, part of the University of Chicago Podcast Network.
I'm wondering what you think about the following, which is that while primaries appear not to have contributed to levels of polarization within Congress, they have contributed to the weakening of parties, by which I mean the ability of parties to exercise discipline within their ranks and to determine who is going to represent them in a general election. It's unfathomable to me to think that in 2016, the Republicans would have nominated Donald Trump to be president, left to their own devices. And what happened was that a primary season allowed Trump to force his way into the party and to ultimately take it over. But all the party stalwarts left to their own devices would have refused to bring him on board. And Trump isn't a story. What distinguishes Trump isn't necessarily his ideological extremism, but he's a very different type of Republican. It's in this way that primaries may have mattered a bunch.
I'm sure that's right. I mean, the party is kind of a nebulous concept, but if the party is being defined by the group of insiders who used to decide things in the old days, they're definitely weaker because they have less power because of primaries. That's surely true. If you ignore Trump for just a second, and I know that's hard to do, but just pretend that you didn't know who Donald Trump was, and or you think of Donald Trump as this like television celebrity who's not involved in politics. What would you say, this is a good thing or a bad thing? Would you say we want the party insiders to have more power, or no, this is a good thing? This is pro-democracy. This is pro-accountability. This is good that the party insiders don't get to control things and they don't get to force members of Congress to vote the way they want, lest they risk not getting reappointed.
There are trade-offs.
Yeah, I think it's worth lingering on this point a little bit, because I think it's a bigger point that every time there are trade-offs, I think we have a tendency to focus on the latest thing that didn't go the way we would like it to go, and we emphasize that, and we try to advocate changes to the system that would decrease this negative impact of the thing that just happened. And we forget that there are trade-offs, so bad things will happen in either direction. I think this is something that's happening over and over again in other contexts, where we forget that there are trade-offs and we are going to see bad outcomes from time to time in those situations. And that doesn't mean that we haven't resolved the trade-off in the optimal way when it comes to the institutions that we've created.
I mean, there's all kinds of benefits of primaries. If you live in a one-party dominated place, primaries are your only opportunity for selection and accountability, right? If you're voting for Congress in Illinois, there's a pretty good chance that there's almost no competition in your general election. And so your best hope is, maybe I have a choice in the Democratic primary. And that's a good thing. I think that's on net a really good thing. I don't trust that the party insiders themselves, they're going to decide who the best candidate is for us. I'd like to have the option to vote for someone else if someone better emerges.
That's right. But then when you see that in lots of primaries, turnout is on the order of 10, 12, 15%, the idea that 10, 12, 15% is broadly representative of the larger public maybe not, or is that just a bunch of extremists who are showing up and having their way? And to add to that, you can also think about how the only decision is not whether or not to have primaries, but when to have them, and how open the voting process is, and how much information is provided to voters, and how available are the polls. There are all kinds of other things that we might do in the service of reaching a broader electorate that go beyond simply, you know, the switch from, you know, decisions being made in conventions to decisions being made in primaries.
Of course, an alternative could be, and you will tell me why this is a crazy idea, but an alternative would be, well, let's have an election at large, and everyone can run, and everyone can decide whether they are running as a Republican or as a Democrat. So we have 10 candidates, and then, you know, we might have a runoff election or some system that selects the one that you know, we think gathered the biggest support. And you know, that sort of, I think, brings up a different set of concerns, but at least we get rid of this issue that candidates are nominated by someone in a smoke-filled backroom, and the concern that you have two different electorates voting. You have different electorates voting in the primary, selecting candidates, and then only then we have the median voter speaking her preferences.
And Veal, you just reminded though us about the importance of thinking about trade-offs all the way through. In listening to you, I kept thinking about going to the toothpaste aisle right now, where I want some good toothpaste, but now I freeze up. I don't know about you two. I freeze up because there are 1,000 kinds of toothpaste. And the idea that my interests are being better represented because there are 1,000 kinds of toothpaste out there, I don't know, I lock up.
The Michigan school told me that I'm a Colgate man because my parents were Colgate people.
But it turns out there are 15 kinds of Colgate. Even if
Colgate, yes.
That only takes you so far. And so, right, this is the thing, right, which is that, are we made better off? Are our preferences better represented in the absence of any kind of gatekeeping function, any kind of curation? That seems unlikely.
So I want to go back to, you know, how we started this podcast a little bit. We talked about Donald Baldock and him changing positions between the primary season and the election season. And Anthony, you mentioned a little bit about your research on this topic. So I wonder what your thinking is about to what extent candidates are able to actually present themselves in a very different light during the primary campaign and during the general election campaign. Is, you know, definitely when you are a first-time candidate, you seem to have more room because you don't have any voting record. But I wonder to what extent you think this might be happening to everyone, and that is part of the explanation for why we didn't see this polarizing effect of the primaries.
Yeah, I'm sure some of this is definitely going on. I'm sure it is the case that, you know, I mean, I'm old enough to remember the flip-flop allegations against John Kerry and so forth. You know, this is definitely a common thing that you see candidates kind of, they'll either change their positions or they just change what they emphasize in campaigns. Once the primary is over, you moderate a little bit. And the same thing appears to be true in Congress, where they moderate their roll call voting a little bit once the primary is over and they're thinking about the general. It's not a big effect. And I suspect most of it is kind of cheap talk, in the sense that most voters know that they know your actual positions, they know your record, they know where you stand. Maybe you can, on the margin, influence their views of you a little bit, but I don't think voters are so naive that they're going to say to themselves, like, oh, you know, Bernie Sanders turns out to be a moderate because the second that he won the presidential primary, that hasn't happened yet. I'm predicting this for the future. That it turns out, I don't anticipate that this will happen, but it turns out Bernie Sanders became a raging moderate all of a sudden as soon as he went to debate Ron DeSantis or something. I don't think that's going to happen. But you know, if it did happen, I don't think the voters would think like, oh yeah, Bernie Sanders is a moderate now. They would know that this is kind of cheap talk, and they wouldn't update much in response to it. So even though I'm not surprised that it happens from time to time, I doubt that it has a huge electoral effect, and I doubt that there's lots of voters who fall for it. But you're right, it's easier for a candidate who is not a longtime incumbent, who has less of a reputation. Maybe there's more benefits for them to do it. Yeah, I'm sure.
And I wonder to what extent that might also shape our perception of the polarizing effect of the primaries, because we do focus, at least the media does focus on those candidates that seem really outrageous, that make outrageous claims, and they win the primaries. And then perhaps they all go to Congress and they know next time they have a record that they are running on, so they cannot be too extreme. So we have this perception that primaries really contribute to these very strange people being elected, but perhaps, you know, when we look down the road, they are actually more moderate than what we would have thought when we were observing them at the primary campaign stage.
Can I float something? If the three of us are good conservatives, and in the primary section, primary season, we're being asked who's going to represent us as conservatives, that is going to elicit a different set of considerations, even knowing that around the bend is a general election. It's about what do we stand for, right? What is our worldview and who's going to represent our worldview? And that will elicit different kinds of responses within a person than you would get within that same person when the conversation turns to who's going to represent the country or who's going to represent the state or who's going to represent the district. And then we're all in this together and we're all Americans or we're all from Chicago and who's going to represent our views. In that way, and this, you know, get out your crystals and your incense, there are multiple selves, right, that are being expressed, that inhabit, you know, that live within each of us.
We're levitating now.
Right? But like, right, you know, when if I try to say, Viola, who are you? I mean, part of who you are is somebody with an ideological disposition. And if I accentuate the set of considerations around that, I'm going to get different kinds of responses. And then when it's, but you also are a resident of a city, a state, a country. And that they're different sets of concerns being, I mean, they're not mutually exclusive, obviously, but that are being accentuated in primaries versus general elections. And that might contribute to why candidates talk in different ways that goes beyond simply compositional differences in who makes up a primary versus a general electorate.
It might be the case. I think what I see is more of this flip-flopping things. Like, I do want to fool the voters. I do want to make them believe that I'm a conservative on abortion. I'm going to pursue these kind of policies when in Washington. And then I want to convince the general voting population of the opposite. But I think you're bringing up an interesting point.
We have multiple selves and they're authentic. That's what I'm suggesting. They're all authentic. And that they aren't, and that they may actually be, it's hard to reconcile them.
So it's good to get to vote in the primaries where we can express one.
Yes.
Part of our identity, and then in the general election, yes.
Yeah, and then I say, what does it mean to be American? We're all in this together. That's going to elicit something different. Okay.
I don't know what we're talking about anymore. Okay, fine.
I'm going to get out my lava lamp and...
Sure. Okay. I mean, on some level, you must be right that, like, yes, you can choose which things you talk about, and we all have different considerations floating around in our head, and we can choose which ones we emphasize depending on who we're talking to and the setting and so forth. But there are some periods of time where they just completely, just straight up change their position. Like, you went from saying the one thing, and then isn't it convenient that you just so happened to change your view 180 degrees right at the time when it would be politically expedient for you to do so? Like, that's not what you're talking about. Like, there are clear cases that Viola's talking about where just for political benefits, you magically change your positions. And I think that's the kind of thing that voters look at and your opponents look at and publicize to the extent they can. And they can say, this guy maybe doesn't have any principles. And we don't really know where they stand. And we shouldn't trust them. And we shouldn't trust that they're going to do what they say when they're in office. And I think we're right to think that.
Yeah. My suggestion is not that flip-flopping doesn't happen. It does. And that flip-flopping might represent an absence of principles. It might well. But that our understandings of ourselves and of the world are layered and complicated. And sometimes we see it as from an ideological perspective or a partisan perspective, which is about what's good for the party, what's good in a principled sense about being a true liberal or a true conservative. And other instances, what we're being asked about is what's good for our community, our state, our country. And that those don't align perfectly, but that they reside within us simultaneously. And that will lead to differences of emphasis, and which aren't just about flip-flopping, that it's about speaking to, here we go, the multiple cells that reside within all of us.
That's a good.
But and that's authentic. That's not. That's a real thing. That's what makes this interesting.
As long as we don't have to sign on to all of that. I mean, you're making a fine point, but you're making some like metaphysical, almost supernatural point that you need not. Like, I don't think you need to.
I can't resist though. It's there to be had.
And changing your mind is fine too, right? I mean, there's nothing wrong. I mean, a serious person should change their mind from time to time. That's often lost in these conversations. But if you only ever change your mind when it just so happens to be the most politically expedient thing to do, then it sort of makes people wonder that you haven't really changed your mind. You're just saying whatever you think people want you to say, and we have no idea what you're actually going to do when the stakes are high.
So, what's your bottom line?
Well, I was really pleased to read this paper. I mean, it's another null effects paper, but this is an important null effects paper because it speaks to something that we hear all the time, which is the fear of being primaried as justification for the assumption of more extreme positions. Like, you know, it's sort of offered up as a pass for why somebody has to take the position that's broadly out of step with your typical voter, because if she doesn't, boy, she's likely to lose office. And here's some evidence that suggests not. It leaves in play the possibility that primaries matter in ways that go beyond polarization, just as it leaves in play questions about what's really driving the polarization. But this is an important paper by a set of really thoughtful scholars that have updated my own thinking about the matter, and I was really glad to read it.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I think it's a really great paper. I mean, Jim was my advisor, so I'm supposed to say that. And I think
you're expressing your authentic self.
And he, you know, I mean, Jim has written, you know, like hundreds of papers that I think are really great and influence me and change the way that I think about things. And so it was really fun to interview him for this episode and talk about his paper. And I should mention, we mentioned a couple times that Jim and Shigeo together have this book on primary elections, which has just a really impressive number of analyses and results where they, you know, they spent many years working on this thing. And it's very, very comprehensive. And I strongly recommend it. There's no good way to summarize it except to say that, like, you know, everything you want to know about primaries that we know is in that book. Like, maybe there's some open questions that we don't know the answer to, but everything that we as a field knows about primaries is pretty much in that book. And it's really good. And it's really interesting and really comprehensive. And so I would strongly recommend that people read that.
Yeah, so I also enjoyed the paper. I want to, again, you know, go back to this idea of trade-offs, that when we think about institutions, there's no perfect institution. There are always trade-offs. And I think this paper reminds us about this. When we think, we see electoral outcomes that we don't like, we try to find a guilty institution and we try to advocate changing this institution. They say, well, let's be careful about this. Let's see what are the alternatives. And basically when they say, well, when we compare this institution to alternatives, we don't see an effect, which sort of suggests, you know, all institutions have some dark sides and might sometimes generate outcomes that we don't like. So I really enjoyed this paper, and I think it's amazing how it disproves in some sense this idea that's so powerful and that's floating out there in the media that, you know, we found the culprit for all the ills that are affecting our democracy.
Thanks for listening to Not Another Politics Podcast.
Our show is a podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy and is produced by Matt Hodapp. Thanks for listening. Mm-hmm.